Thank you, guys. I can't, like, follow that. That's I appreciate that. Okay, I wasn't going to originally ask this question, but let me actually ask, how many of you told your husband what we were talking about today? How many of you did not dare? We're like, I'm not telling you until I figure out what we're hearing today. Yeah. This topic, I cannot believe I'm standing up here. I'm a social researcher. I can't even talk. What on earth? But I cannot believe that I'm standing up on stage talking about sex. Because for years, I've been doing this research for about 20 years on helping men and women understand each other and understanding what makes for great marriages and parenting secrets and the things your kids are thinking and workplace stuff. And we've done all of these big research studies over the years. And when I felt God like knocking on, you know, my head, because the two of the big issues in marriage are sex and money, right? And it kept coming up. And so we did the money one. We did a money book called Thriving in Love and Money, not on how to have a good budget, but how to have a great marriage around money. And then I felt like the Lord was like, you know what has to be next? I'm like, no, mm-mm. No, I'm not going to do that. But I felt so strongly. And so we ended up recruiting one of the foremost sex therapists in the country who's trained many, many, many of the Christian sex therapists out there especially, but many other sex therapists as well. His name is Dr. Michael Seitzma. And we recruited him to do the research and to do the book with us because I knew there is no way that I can tackle this topic well on something that is so sacred and so vulnerable and has so many facets. If I got something just a little bit wrong, like, I could do damage, right, in people's lives. And so what I'm going to you today is my reluctant results of my to be able to dig into the things that really matter. Now, what we're going to be covering, just so you guys know, when I talk about research, the studies that we have done over the years are big, robust, nationally representative research studies, this one included. So we have now interviewed and surveyed more than 42,000 men and women over the years. These are not Facebook polls. These are nationally representative. We've spent almost $900,000 over the last 20 years. I am wondering, Miles, whether I might need a different microphone, because it doesn't seem like it's going out to you a little bit. So, if it goes out again, let's see if I can get a handheld, even though I talk with my hands. So when I'm on a handheld, I kind of feel mute. So let's see if it'll stick around. So we're going to be diving into the results of this. But just so you know, we'll be talking about some data, but for you to be aware that I am going to be making some significant generalizations. That's the only thing that you can do in a short period of time with the limited sort of space that we have to talk about it. And just so you know, on this topic in particular, there are wide, wide variations. There's lots of exceptions. And especially because we're all women here, and we're gonna be talking about this topic, one of the things for you guys to know is I'm gonna be leaning into the data that I think we need to know as women, which also includes some data about men, without spending the time also talking about what men need to know about us. That's why Jeff and I do marriage events, right? Jeff and I will do marriage conferences, and we'll talk about both, but because we have just a limited time, I'm going to be leaning into what we as women need to know. And then there is a lot of good data in the book and in For Women Only and For Men Only, okay? So you can get both sides. All right, so Here is what we're going to do. We are going to be tackling four myths about this topic, because there are many, many different ways that we can tackle this. We all come to this topic with so many preconceived notions. And the issue is, I don't know, you guys may be different than the people we've interviewed and surveyed over the years, But the funny thing is about this topic, it is so central to marriage in so many ways, and yet it's one of the only topics that we just never talk about, even with like our closest friends, right? Like, how often do you just sit down around coffee with two couples and talk about your sex lives? Like, it just doesn't happen, right? And so we come at this with, we've gotten information from some, maybe some good sources. Maybe we've read a book that has been written by a sex therapist. It's got, you know, good information. But maybe we've read a book that wasn't written by a sex therapist and had a lot of pop culture information that ends up not being true, right? Or what if most of us, I hate to say this out loud, especially in a church, but most of us, we don't realize we get a lot of our sex information from movies. Like, this is the way things work. And it's without realizing, actually, wait a second, there's probably some of that that is not accurate. Or the joke when Jeff and I do marriage events, the joke that Jeff always tells the guys is, how many of you feel like your primary education was at 15 years old in the locker room? Right? Like, 15-year-old boys are not the most accurate purveyors of information on this topic. And so there are a lot of things that come up in our intimate lives. There are so many issues. There's emotions. There's so much. Sometimes there's beauty, and sometimes there's discord and hurt feelings, and sometimes there's incredible closeness. When we have the problems, we can talk about the problems. We could talk about, for example, an orgasm gap, right? We could talk about this, we could talk about that, but I want to talk about what's underneath those things. And so what's underneath those things, we can dig out with these four myths, okay? And by the way, I'm going to encourage you guys, does anybody have one of these in their purse or their phone to take notes on? Seriously, grab something that you can take notes on, because I promise you, there are going to be a couple of moments where you're like, oh, I have to remember that. I'm going to forget that. Or I need to ask my husband, is that true of him? Or I need to start researching this for myself and my own, like, you know, health in this area. And so take notes on your phone, take notes on a piece of paper, whatever it is, in order to be able to deal with this. And then, as you know, I love the fact that you guys have a discussion time afterwards. Okay, so here's the four myths that we're going to talk about. First, myth number one, other people are not dealing with the stuff we're dealing with. That's myth number one, and it is a big fat myth, because it's simply not true, but it is easy to feel that it is true. It is really easy to feel very isolated in this area. Like I said, this is one of those places we don't even talk about with our best girlfriends half the time. Like guys, the men often, like my husband does a men's group, right? And he says this is what will happen sometimes in a men's group if there's trust and they've maybe been together for a while and they're able to share like real life together. One of the men will say, yeah, it's just not a lot of action going on in our house right now. And all the other men are like, okay. So about the game, right? Like that's about as deep as it goes. And one of the things, so we have no grid for what's going on out there. And so one of the main questions that people ask is, are we normal? Am I normal? And I'm going to give you some numbers. I'm going to debunk this myth by telling you that no matter what is going on in your marriage, and I mean that literally, no matter what it is that's going on in your intimate life, you are not alone. And it is almost 100%, not quite 100%, but almost 100% likely that there are other people probably in this room who are dealing with even some things you think are really unusual. No, they're not. You are not alone. And so let's tackle just one of those myths, and we're going to see this running through as a thread through a bunch of the others. Okay. One of the most common disconnects around the topic of physical intimacy in our marriages is one person in the couple simply wants kind of more action than is happening, right? That is one of the most common disconnects. That is the case for 79% of couples. 79% of couples. Now, 21% of couples, they are on the same page about how much frequency they want. That doesn't necessarily mean they're connecting well, but they're on the same page roughly about how much frequency that they want. Now, people always come up to me afterwards. I'm going to save you this question because people always come up afterwards and they're like, how often should we? Right? Like, how often should we connect? And it's hilarious because Dr. Seitzma, who we wrote the book with, he was like, under no circumstances do you ever answer that question. And so when we talked about the reason why you should never answer that question, it was actually really revealing. Because basically the premise under that question is that there is a right should for everybody. And the reality is everybody is different and there is no one answer to that. So a good analogy, this is going to sound funny, but a good analogy would be if somebody comes up to me after a talk on animal welfare and says, should we have a pet? I don't know. Like, do you live in a busy neighborhood? Are you traveling all the time and unable to get home to walk the dog? Do you have allergies? Like, do you have other things that would make it good or bad? Like, I don't know the answer to that. Should you have a pet? It may be that 70% of the people in your neighborhood have a pet, but that's not right for you. And it's kind of that same concept with how often should we connect. Every couple is different. I'll give you some averages, though. I'm going to give you some numbers, and I want you to write this down on a pie chart. If you have the ability, draw a circle. And I'm going to show you visually. I don't have a presentation here today, but I'm going to show you visually on a pie chart. And I want you to on the first part of the pie chart, the first quarter, I want you to write 23%. 23% of couples are in what sex therapists consider to be basically sexless marriages. Okay, less than once a month or never. Now, only 9% is never, okay? But 23% are in these kind of sexless marriages. The next quarter is 28%. It's not quite a quarter, it's a little bit more. 28% of people are having sex 1 to 3 times a month. These are married couples, and we did the largest matched pair nationally representative survey on this topic that's ever been done. And so these numbers are really robust. So 28% are having sex 1 to 3 times a month. The next piece is 29%, again, a little bit more than a quarter, which is 1 to 2 times a week. 29% of couples are connecting 1 to 2 times a week, and 15% are connecting 3 to 6 times a week. And then the last piece of the pie is a robust 4% that are having sex daily or more. Jeff and I were doing it. We were doing an event. Okay, seriously, this is one of the funniest things that's happened to us in years of traveling. We were doing an event in San Diego, huge marriage event. There were probably 2,500 people in the room, which is big for a marriage event. Often it's a lot smaller than that. So probably 2,500 people, this big auditorium. And we had a question and answer time. We often have these live question and answer times. And we use a interactive program called Slido to like actually do live polling and where people can ask anonymous questions and that kind of thing. And so one of the questions comes up and it says, is 10 times a week too many? And everybody's like, ha, ha, that's so funny, you know? Like, everybody thought that was hilarious, right? So this young couple, they're like 22 years old, comes up to us afterwards. They're like, no, really, is it too many? And we're like, go for it. If both of you are on the same page, that's impressive, okay? So that's the 4% or more. But if I could just point out, there's about 100 people in the room, so... four of you. Anyway, I'm just saying. All right. So let me point out something about that pie chart you just drew. Take a look at it. Do you see that it's basically a quarter, a quarter, a quarter, a quarter? There is no one should. You, whatever is going on in your marriage, you're normal and you're not alone. Okay? All right. Myth number two. This is a big one. And this is one that's where a lot of the arguments and a lot of the heartache start. Myth number two is, if we are connecting less often than one person wants, there's one reason why. And it's that one person has a lower libido. One person has a lower sex drive. That's just the assumption. And statistically, that person is more likely to be a woman than the man. And so statistically, what that does is it puts a lot of pressure on the quote-unquote lower sex drive person, which is usually the wife. And it's basically like, well, if you'd get your act together, you know, we'd be connecting more often. That is so unfair, and it's so much pressure on so many probably of us in the room. And we assume these negative things that come out of it. We assume, and often the husband would assume, I'm not desirable to her. She just doesn't want me, right? Or we may assume all he wants is to get busy. Like, he doesn't care about me. Like, he doesn't care that I've had a hard day and I've been chasing kids around and, you know, that I'm exhausted. And what we found out in the research, and this was actually Mike Seitzma's dissertation that went all the way back to that, is that most of the distress, and I can't remember the number, but it was something like 79 or 77% of the distress around an intimate life disconnect comes not from not connecting at a certain frequency. It comes from what we believe about why. It comes from what we believe about our spouse, saying, I'm just not desirable to him. Or whatever it is, that the story that you're telling yourself, whatever that is where the disconnect usually comes. And so what we found, and this is myth number three, what we found about if we're disconnected and we're not, one person just has a lower libido, it turns out that is a myth, and it ties, there's another whole set of reasons, it's one of the reasons we wrote the book, is to deal with what are those other reasons that have nothing to do with different sex drives, okay? And one of those main reasons that we're going to spend a few minutes on here, we're going to land on this and camp here for a few minutes, one of the main reasons why is that it's often nothing to do about different levels of desire, but different types of desire. So myth number three is there is just one pattern about how sex works. And here's the pattern. And let me tell you, when I tell you this, I want you to now notice how often you're going to see this pattern everywhere in movies and television and books and just in general in media, okay? Here's the pattern that we think this is just how sex works. The guy and the girl look at each other. Okay, picture any movie about this topic. The guy and the girl look at each other, and there's a spark. and there's a hunger. And they're like, you want to do it? And both of them are like, yes. And pretty soon they're kissing and the clothes are off and they're in bed. And usually the camera goes gracefully away, okay? But we think that's just how sex works. But it doesn't necessarily work that way in our household. And so we think if that's not how it works in our household, something's broken. Maybe if that's not the way it works for us, we think we're broken. Or our husband thinks we're broken. Everybody has this, something's wrong, something's not working the way it should, because that is not what it looks like. And one of the things we have to be aware of is that the reason that is not what it looks like, that our life may not look like that. Now, for some of you, maybe that 4%, it does look like that. I don't know, okay? But for most of us, here's what you have to know. It is not just that you're chasing little kids around and you're exhausted. That's a piece of it. But that's not the main piece. Instead, the issue is that there are two types of desire, and that Hollywood version is one of them. You could call that initiating desire. You feel a surge of desire, and you do something about it. And probably the person who has initiating desire is thinking about it a lot, okay, and is ready at a moment's notice. Guess who tends to have initiating desire, right? It tends to be more likely to be men. Now, it's not only, I think it was something like 16% of women have initiating desire, okay? But there is a whole nother kind of desire, and that is called receptive desire. And here is the most important thing for you to know about receptive desire, especially for the women in the room who are in this category, which is 73% of women, okay? Receptive desire, the physiology, the way that our bodies are wired, and I would say as a person of faith, the way that God created us, like this isn't an accident, it's the way we're created. The physiology of desire works in the reverse order. We who have receptive desire, we do not feel that sense of hunger and that sense of desire in the same way that someone who has initiating desire does. The person with receptive desire, instead, they decide to get engaged with their spouse. They decide to get engaged knowing that it's going to be good, but they're just not feeling that sexual hunger right this second, but they know that they're going to start feeling it eventually. And as they start getting engaged with their spouse, as their physiology starts getting stimulated, and assuming, and by the way, I should have said this right up front, this is all assuming that this is a reasonably positive, loving marriage, right? Like a normal, non-abusive marriage. Because if there is an abusive marriage, all these things we're talking about, like the application of them is going to be completely different. And so, by the way, I would urge you, if you feel like there's an abusive situation, especially in the area of your sexuality, ask somebody for help. Like, start consulting with someone who can help you figure out what to do about it. But for the vast majority of people who have receptive desire, as they decide to get engaged and as their physiology starts getting stimulated and as it's seen positively, eventually that sense of desire, that physical hunger kicks in that maybe their spouse felt 10 minutes ago. The physiology of a receptive desire person works in the reverse order. And what we tell our marriage events, same thing I'm going to tell you, is the reason this is important for both parties to know. And now, by the way, this is most likely to be women, but not all women. Okay, so just remember, there's exceptions here. But using the women example for just a minute, For those who are in that receptive desire category, what our husbands need to know is that we are deciding whether to get engaged based on how we feel about him and the relationship the rest of the day. That decision is based on something. And that is what so many husbands just completely don't understand, because for those husbands who have initiating desire, one of the things that is a very common issue, and we don't have time to get into the neuroscience, but there is an immense amount of neuroscience and neurobiology behind this that basically shows, and by the way, emotions behind this, that when a husband is feeling disconnected from his wife and feeling like the rest of the day didn't go so well and feeling like, I want to feel close again, guess what he wants to do? He is reaching out, not because he's selfish, because he misses you. That is statistically the most likely explanation. Now, is it going to be the case all the time? No. Is it going to be people who are selfish? Absolutely. We can be selfish too, right? But statistically, the most likely explanation is that we need, and I'm saying we as women, again, I know not everybody is in this category, but that we are deciding to get engaged based on how we feel about him and the relationship the rest of the day, at the same time that he is wanting to try to get engaged in order to build the relationship. So just be aware that, again, the distress, like I said at the beginning, the distress comes often not from the disconnect, but from the story we're telling ourselves about why there's a disconnect. And so knowing these two different types of desire is incredibly important. Now, before I started talking about this, one of the things that I sometimes do when we're talking with the group is I ask the group to guess. Like, okay, we think this is what Hollywood says sex is, and like there's a hunger and we move towards one another and pretty soon the clothes are off and they're in bed and that's the way it should, in air quotes, that's the way it should work. And many people just think that's 100% of couples. That's the way it should work. And if it doesn't work that way in my house, I'm broken. Remember that? Okay. So now let me tell you the actual percent of couples where both spouses have initiating desire. You ready for this? 10%. Only 10% of couples do both spouses have initiating desire. In the vast majority of couples, one person has initiating, one person has receptive. Now, it's not always the man and the woman, it's sometimes flipped. And sometimes, I can't remember the number, it's something like 24%, I think 25% of couples, both people have receptive desire. Now, just so you all know, statistically, men who have receptive desire are more likely to be older. As they get older, sometimes that initiating desire starts flipping. And it's kind of on a spectrum, right? Like I'm saying, as if there's one or the other, there's a little bit of a spectrum. But as men start to get older, which for most of you, that's not the case right now, but just keep in mind that that is often something that happens. So you may have noticed that there's a small percentage that didn't add up to 100%. There's a third type of desire that is a small percentage, it's 3-4% of people. And it's called resistant desire. So we have initiating desire, we have receptive desire, and we have resistant desire. Now, resistant desire, like I said, small percentage, but that's somebody where if initiating is a car that's in drive, and receptive is a car that's in neutral and needs something to drop it into drive, resistant has the parking brake on. Or resistant is in reverse. And it's someone, it could be the husband, it could be the wife, but it's someone who just, there's issues with this and they just don't want to engage. Or there's fear. Or a big one is they've pulled back because there's sexual pain. Take a guess how many women have sexual pain at least every third time that they have sex. Take a guess. Keep going. 60%? A little bit less than that. Did you say 60?
Yeah.
Okay. It's 31%. 31, almost a third of women have sexual pain at least once every three times. Men are horrified to learn this. A lot of men have no idea. Like maybe the wife has tried to say something, but they didn't kind of realize like how big of a deal it was. And men actually have sexual pain too sometimes. But this is an epidemic that is often completely undiscussed. And so for some percentage of women, of course they're gonna be resistant, or men. And so the resistant desire is basically a light. It's a flashing warning light that says, look here, there's something that needs to be addressed. Maybe it's a lack of sense of safety in the relationship. Whatever it is, it's often there for a reason. But the good news is that once you address it, once you actually say, okay, this is a huge part of our relationship, and we really need to like dig into this and figure out what's underneath the resistance, whether it's the husband or the wife, that once you do that work, that usually what happens is that has been masking. That person is naturally initiating or naturally receptive, and they go back to what they are naturally created to be. Okay, I gotta keep going. I'm supposed to stop at 10:30. Can I have another couple of minutes? You sure? All right. Okay, here is what we do with some of that about these two different types of desire, and I'm gonna suggest that you write this down. I'm gonna suggest that you take a couple of notes on this. The most important thing for you to start with is for you to talk to your spouse and figure out where you two fall. So let's just say, picture like a grid, and you know, on one side of the grid is men, on the other side is women, and you have the initiating, receptive, resistant buckets. So you're receptive, he's initiating, and so that's where you two fall. Or maybe it's the reverse. Maybe you're initiating and he's receptive. Maybe both of you are receptive. Where do you fall? Maybe one of you is resistant. Where do the two of you fall? And then discuss, what is it that we can actually do about this? What does this mean? If the two of us together, this is our joint pattern, what does it look like to be able to connect in a much more healthy, in a beautiful way that honors what both of us need? And I'll give you a couple of examples of to-dos for this. The first, because the vast majority of couples in here, one will be initiating and one will be receptive. The person who has receptive desire, usually one of the key action steps is the person who has initiating desire has to give the person with receptive desire what we call anticipation time. Okay? This is the flirting comment in the moment, in the morning, that tells the person with receptive desire what you'd love to have happen later that night. Right? This is my husband, Jeff. I asked his permission to use this example because it was so simple. Like the other day, I can't remember what he did. Oh, he completely like spent hours reinstalling a microwave. Like he was trying to save the money on the installation. You know how that goes, right? Okay. So he thought, oh, it'll be a, you know, 30-minute job. And, you know, 4 hours later, he's still trying to figure out how to install this, like, very complicated situation. And he plugged at it. And I said the next day, I said, thank you so much because, you know, that saved us so much money and things are tight right now. And so it's like, okay, you know, thank you so much for doing that. And he kind of grinned. He was drinking his coffee and he was like, remember that later tonight? And I said, that's a great example. Can I use that on Wednesday when I talk to these women? Now, of course, Dr. Seitzema is horrified that I would say, it's not a trade. You're not, you know, giving to get. And I'm like, okay, fine. I was just having fun. But that's a silly example of like a flirty little comment where someone with receptive desire just may not have been thinking about it. And so now the two people, again, if it's a reasonably healthy relationship, whatever, the two people are roughly on the same page and are both anticipating it. Now, I'm gonna warn you that if you guys are receptive, anyone here who's receptive, who's married to an initiating person, if you go home and tell your husband, you know, about this, he's gonna go, you mean I need to warn you? Right, like that doesn't feel so good, right? Because he's got this idea of, she can't keep her hands off of me, right? Like that's, and I'll talk about that in just a second. I know we gotta wrap up. But that's the first to do, is if you are in two different buckets, the person with initiating desire gives the person with receptive desire anticipation time. That really helps. There's many other things we can do. We just don't have time to get into all of it. The second thing we need to think about, both for that pattern and if both of you are receptive. What happens if both of you are receptive? Sit around and look at each other? So what often happens and is a great pattern for both of these is to schedule sex. Is to actually say, you know, if we don't take control of our schedule, and by the way, statistically, this matters even more for people with young children, just saying. One of the things that is a type of anticipation time is scheduling. Because it's saying, you know, when the kids are off at travel baseball, that's our time, right? It's every Tuesday and Saturday, you know, or whatever. That, when you can have at least one every week time that you can connect, which, by the way, we don't have time to get into it, but statistically, we saw this like dividing line in the data where people who had sex once a week or more, all these good things tended to come from that. It's not like it's a should, it's just we started to see more emotional connectivity, more communication, more of all these different things that tended to fall if people were trying roughly to connect once a week or more. And so try to schedule that, as that's just a mechanism. Okay, I need to move on to the last one because I'm over my time, but I want to give you the fourth myth because this is really important. This gets into what we don't have time to really get into, which is the understanding of men emotionally, okay? That was the study and the survey of men that I did that the two Carries were talking about earlier. Okay, this is a big deal, and I'm just going to get you started. The final myth that we have is that this, what we think of for men as a physical need, physical intimacy is a physical need. It's a physical urge. And you know what? When you've got kids that you're chasing around, sleep seems like a physical need too, right? And when I did the survey of men, when I did all these interviews, and I asked the men, what is the importance of this in your life? What I heard from them had nothing to do with the physical. What I kept hearing from the men was entirely this enormous emotional need that they couldn't get met any other way. And here's what the need is. It's the need that every man has to feel that his wife desires him and that she wants him. And if a man feels that his wife desires him, it gives him a sense, this is the crazy part, it gives him a sense of confidence, it gives him a sense of well-being in all the other areas of his life. It's really, really powerful. Now, does that mean that therefore, oh, well, even though I'm not feeling close, I have to? No, no. That's not what I'm saying at all. But most of us in this room really want to know what our spouse, what the deepest core longings and wants and insecurities are of our spouse, the same way that we want them to know that about us. Which is why we usually do this with both sides of people in the room, so we can talk to both sides. But I just wanted you to be aware that it's not just what you might think it is. It's not just a physical need. There's an enormous emotional need, a tender heart that's down under the surface often in the man that you love. So I wish we could keep going, but I'm going to stop there because I know you guys have a discussion time, and I really, really, really want to get you guys to talking about how this applies to your life. So thank you, guys.